It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, do you know the story of the teen girl who struck out Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig? We'll hear about it along with some other lesser-known legends from baseball history. First, it seems like nothing about life today is quite normal. We're living through a historic time, and while it might not be the first thing you think of, our next guests say this is a good time to take some notes, maybe even a journal. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you recording your experiences during this time somehow? Are you keeping a journal, writing short essays, taking photos, or something else? If you've always kept a journal, has the content changed a lot lately? We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Andy Moore is a senior producer at PBS Wisconsin and host of the 30-Minute Music Hour. He's the lead contributing producer for their COVID-19 project, No Place Like Home. Andy, good to have you with us.
Hi, Rob. How you doing? I miss seeing you. I've seen everybody at the station.
Exactly. Me too. Well, it's good to talk to you anyway on the air. Also with us, Christian Overland is the Ruth and Hartley Barker Director and CEO of the Wisconsin Historical Society, which is asking for contributors to their COVID-19 journal project. Christian, thanks a lot for being with us today.
It's a pleasure to be here, Rob, with you and Andy.
Christian, let's start with your project. Where did this idea to ask Wisconsinites to keep these COVID-19 journals come from?
Well, it came actually from the staff. A few of our staff members were talking about, as we were shutting down some of the sites, how could we stay connected and how could we help people out during this time? And the idea actually harkens back to the 1860s when one of our founding directors, Lyman Draper, came up with the journaling project for Civil War soldiers. He was at Camp Randall when people were being mustered out in 1861, and he gave soldiers journals and pencils and asked them to write down what was going on during the war and bring them back to deposit at the Wisconsin Historical Society. And they actually did that. So it created one of the greatest archives of Civil War soldiers' diaries in the United States. So today we were looking at it from the standpoint, wouldn't it be great to actually document this from the people's point of view as well and capturing their moments of time on what they think they're going through and documenting that and actually creating a gift towards the future so people who are looking back on this can say, how did people get through it? So hey, that's Christian, how we started. It was a staff-initiated idea.
And if people want to participate, Christian, how do they get involved?
So it's real simple. You can go to wisconsinhistory.org and look for Big Histories Happening, and they can sign up by actually committing to the journal program. It talks about what happens with the journals, how it'll be cataloged. And we're taking journals that are handwritten, digital, video journals, as well as photo montages. And if people wanted to ask our archivists about the project, too, and getting some more insight about what to do, they can do that through email as well. And then people download a little sign saying, I'm participating in the COVID-19 journaling project, and we ask people to post it on social media, and it all starts that process.
And Andy, you have this fascinating project going at PBS Wisconsin, the No Place Like Home project. What was the goal when you set out here?
What we discussed it when we launched this about a month ago, and our theory is that for every person who is hungry to read about numbers, there are people who are hungry to read about people and how we're doing, how we're all faring, how we're making our way through these social restriction days, and so we decided that I guess you could say that my journaling project is a little bit different from Christian's because it comes in the form of other people's experiences, but you could say that I'm their journalist. So we set out to tell people stories and how they're doing at home, hence the name No Place Like Home.
And you've got an amazing variety of people already. I think this is still in early days, but a high school student in Milwaukee, a farmer who's in a blues band, just across the board here. Can you share a couple of the stories of the people you met with us?
Yes, and we are. Some are more lighthearted, and some are very serious. I like the examples that you talked about, and I want to touch on one of those as well. But a recent one that just went up was more lighthearted, although it points out to a serious problem, and it's the story of an Iowa County man who is a UW tech information specialist who doesn't have broadband. out in the country. And so he has to, as I put it in the story, drive to work at home. And he parks on the side of the highway and works 8 hours a day and then drives 10 minutes home. But so that was an example of someone handling this home. Listen, please hear me say that any of us who are fortunate enough to be able to have work to work at home is worth acknowledging. But this was an interesting story with a guy with a unique challenge who then found a way to solve it. But in doing so, the story also points out a parallel challenge, which is broadband is not saturated throughout Wisconsin. And in these times when students are finishing their school year online, it matters in that way in a very important way as well.
We're talking about recording our stories of our lives during the COVID-19 pandemic in a couple different ways. Andy Moore is with us from PBS Wisconsin. He's telling us about the No Place Like Home project there. Christian Overland is with us, director and CEO of the Wisconsin Historical Society. They are asking people to sign on and share journals of various sorts that then will become part of, in effect, the historical record. Now, Christian, on the journal writing project, I know the few times in my life when I've tried to keep a diary or journal or whatever, I don't know what to write. I don't know what to say. You have some prompts that you suggest at the Historical Society. What kind of things for people in my position can we ask ourselves to get the pen flowing there?
Well, that's a great question, Rob. And so what we do is we ask people to think about what's different than the day before yesterday. We prompt them to think about what they're doing weeks before, too, to think about what was life changed for you and how do you feel about that. It could be also to help people prompting journal writing the idea of what have you noticed in your daily life that's changed and what are you thinking about for the future. So we're getting a lot of responses from people that have people wrote back already to us about what they're documenting, from high school seniors that are missing their graduations. And they were saying, well, how do I write about this? And our archivists were prompting them and saying, what would you want to have happen and what are you experiencing now? And so I think those are really helpful things. We have about 20 prompts on our website at wisconsinhistory.org. And we've had over 1,400 people commit to giving us their journals.
That's a fantastic lead-in, Andy, to the high school student I mentioned in Milwaukee who's answering basically those exact questions that Christian just brought up. Can you tell us a little bit about what he had to say?
And I'm making it a point to also ask a question, and I asked this of Devante Himes. This is a Washington high school senior that you mentioned. I'm also making a point to ask people I'm engaging with, what are you doing that you weren't doing before, as opposed to what do you miss doing? Mm-hmm. And Devante's answer was, I'm reaching out to people like I never have before. He talked about reaching out to his peers. He talked about reaching out to his friends who are less motivated, trying to do their studies online than he is. This is a young man on the north side. When I asked him if any family members were C positive, responded that both his grandmother and his aunt are C positive. So this is someone who, when I ask, as I said, what are you doing now that you weren't doing before? This is someone who is doubling down on trying to reach out to people.
And Christian, that makes me think back to those Civil War diaries that you mentioned, and if we might see similar things here. People in an unusual time, in a crisis situation, obviously being a Civil War soldier, different than sheltering at home today. But do you think similar themes might emerge, similar themes of reaching out and thinking about our place in the world?
Well, definitely. I mean, we have some journals from a Wisconsin Volunteer Regiment that was at Gettysburg, for instance, in one of the big battles there, a three-day siege. And journals from that were actually documenting what was going on during the time. And actually a lieutenant colonel's journal documenting the men that were lost as well as wounded. And when I hear about what's being turned into our archivists or people asking questions, we're getting some people that are documenting, their temperature, taking their temperature every day, documenting conversations they're having with colleagues, in other places too. So one of the things that we'll see definitely are themes of this time, And that's why it's so important for what was PBS Wisconsin's doing with their TV outreach, as well as us, is that we are creating the record of a time that people will see trends through it. And so right now we have tools that we're seeing trends that everybody's been hearing about, such as Zoom virtual meetings, like Zoom social hours and cocktail hours, those type of things. Tools like that didn't exist before, but some of the trends existed before, and that's what we'll be able to connect with. The other thing that I think that we'll be able to connect with, too, is how did people get through tough times, and writing about that and helping each other out. And that definitely came through the Civil War journals, and it's definitely coming through this time, too, through COVID-19 journals.
We're talking about keeping a record of our lives during the COVID-19 pandemic. Christian Overland is with us from the Wisconsin Historical Society. They're asking people to keep journals, some form of journals, and then when it's all over, hopefully soon, share those journals with the Historical Society. Also with us, Andy Moore from PBS Wisconsin, lead contributing producer for their COVID-19 project, No Place Like Home. You can see the stories there, read the stories there at the PBS Wisconsin website, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you keeping some kind of journal, a diary, a photo collection, videos, whatever it might be, documenting your life and how it may have changed and maybe what stayed the same too? Are you a longtime journal keeper? What's different now maybe in your journals as compared to what it used to be? And have you looked back either at historical journals or maybe something from a family member and looking at how they went through a tough time in the past? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our conversation now with Andy Moore from PBS Wisconsin and Christian Overland from the Wisconsin Historical Society about projects that document life in Wisconsin during the coronavirus pandemic. Andy is leading the No Place Like Home project for PBS Wisconsin, sharing stories of people's lives during the COVID-19 pandemic. And Christian and the Historical Society want your help. They want you to keep journals and then share them. Call 800-642-1234 if you have a story to share. Do you always keep a journal? Are you a journaler in general? What has that done for your life? What is it like now? How has it changed maybe as we're staying home a lot more during COVID-19? Have you started keeping some kind of record, either on social media, in print, in some other way, video, photo? Call and tell us about it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Andy, I had asked Christian how people can join in his project. Are you on the hunt at PBS Wisconsin for more people to share their stories with you?
Yes, I am. And so this is a really great opportunity for us to do a little bit of outreach on that. And if people go on to the PBS Wisconsin website and check in with us via email with story ideas, we will give those a very serious look and be very, very grateful for any suggestions.
We had a comment from a listener who can stay on. Jan called and said she wanted to say how important toilet paper is right now in small towns. That's people have talked about that a lot, Christian, and I think that's the kind of detail that if we look at this from 20 or 30 years back, people might forget. Is that the kind of like mundane detail of life that you're hoping to collect at the Historical Society?
It is. Excuse me. It is. We actually send people out to photograph grocery stores, too, to help tell that story as well. I think that's not only just toilet paper, but, you know, we have photographs of people coming back from grocery stores sending in things about, do you guys want photographs of empty shelves, no soup, no pasta? There's some food themes that we're all experiencing, too. And so those are the type of things that we're collecting. The other part that I would say about the journaling project, too, is for people to understand, is it's not just an archive of journals by themselves. We are collecting the state history of COVID-19 from the state record point of view, and also 3D collections we're sending our curators across the state. So we're visiting distilleries, talking to them about can they send us their packages that they're now making hand sanitizer in their bottles, and they're sending those to us, as well as we'll be collecting testing kits that are made by Exact Science and other groups too. So we're developing an entire collection on COVID-19.
And that that homebrew hand sanitizer, Andy, reminds me of a Greendale area seamstress, I think, who has converted production to all face masks all the time. Could you share a little of that story with us?
Yes. Her name is Yur Lohr, and she and several friends, one or two of whom worked in her alteration shop in the Greendale shopping mall. After the mall essentially closed, the machines left the building and went into the homes of she and her friends, and they began making masks full-time, hundreds of them. This was before the federal government began to endorse the wearing of masks. So she got a little bit ahead of the game, so much so that she began to get orders, including from an elder care facility down in Illinois. So she was already shipping out masks completely free of charge to various health agencies and so forth. And I have to tell you that after we did that story, a package arrived in our mailbox, and she had sent us a half a dozen.
Wow. That's, you know, and Christian, that makes me wonder how historians ultimately are going to look back and use stories like this, either ones that Andy's collecting or the ones people keep for themselves. Looking back at your collection now, what do we go back and use these personal life stories for?
Well, I think it's very important. And when I think about like the 1918 pandemic that happened in Wisconsin, one of the things that a lot of people don't know about, Wisconsin was the only state in the union that had a medical system at the state level to figure out how to stop the spread of that virus through quarantining, what we call social distancing today. They pulled the kids back from school. So those stories were available, and we sent them to, of course, government officials and everybody else too. But those are the things that people have been talking about, is like how the history has inspired people to figure out how to deal with COVID-19 today. So just like what Andy's talking about with people making masks, saving some of those templates, having those type of things, the kind of can-do spirit that allows people to move forward on their own, those are the stories that we want to give to the future. We want to have the ingenuity of that's coming out of today's crisis be helpful to the future generations of the United States.
We're talking about keeping a record of this unusual time in history here in Wisconsin. Christian Overland with us from the Wisconsin Historical Society. Andy Moore with us from PBS Wisconsin. They have a No Place Like Home project online, and the Historical Society is looking for journals and other records, mementos of this time here in Wisconsin. Christian, I should ask about another project you have going on there, getting people to design posters, like public health posters. What's going on with that?
So, Andy, thanks for asking about that. That's our COVID-19 poster project. We have over 5,000 historical posters in our collections that go back from World War I to the Depression era, World War II, that are call-to-action posters. And what we've done is we've commissioned with 10 Wisconsin artists, graphic design artists, to publish their versions of what could be dealt with today with COVID-19. So we're using the past to inspire the future again. And so Keegan One-Foot Winkman just did a poster last week for us. It's called Shelter in Place. And people can see those posters. We're putting them around town, too, as well as they can make their own poster. We developed a school program for kids that can do things at home, too, and teachers are using it. And that's at wisconsinhistory.org that people can see those and download them. And we're doing 1 week for 10 weeks. So 10 artists, 10 weeks, 10 messages about what we're dealing with in COVID. And we're actually creating the history today for the future as well by that project.
And Andy, I don't want to run out of time without asking about one of your pieces that I know has got to be near and dear to your heart. I've been lucky enough to see you out front, out in your front yard playing banjo since this all started. And you wrote a piece on another, I think, Madison area musician, para musicians who are sharing their tunes with neighbors, even though they can't, you know, go out and have a normal live performance.
Oh, man, it's such a sweet thing. Bobby Batico and Lori Dawkin, our Near East Side residents, and good musicians, bluegrass and country musicians. And, you know, we're living in days of a lot of musicians doing live streaming. Well, Bobby and Loy are doing a two-song live performance on their front porch. And it's intended for passerbys and for their immediate around the corner neighbors. And it's all very, very safe. Partly due to the fact that they only play two songs and partly due to the fact that they have chalk markings out front, like a football field. Most people sit even across the street. And it's a beautiful and sweet nightly event. They've been doing it every night since March 28th. And the song they play is a song that they pick, maybe one that they've written, maybe a country standard. And the second song is always a sing-along, and it's very, very emotional. A very emotional 10 minutes, and then everyone goes home.
And Christian, as we wrap up in our last minute here, I think a lot of us, myself included, think of history as something that happened then. And the present is something that's happening now. We're actually living through history, aren't we?
We are. We're living in one of the largest, most significant transformative moments of our lives and our parents' lives, our grandparents' lives, as well as the future lives of our children. This is an amazing, time for us to be alive and thinking about what the future of the world will be when we get out of it.
We'll leave it there for now. Christian, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, sir, and thank you, Andy.
And Andy, thanks for being with us.
Yes, thanks, Rob. Thanks, Christian. Keep up the good work, Christian.
We've been talking to Christian Overland, Ruth and Hartley Barker, Director and CEO of the Wisconsin Historical Society, which is collecting COVID-19 journals for their collection. And Andy Moore is the lead contributing producer for PBS Wisconsin's COVID-19 project called No Place Like Home. You can learn more about these projects to document life in Wisconsin during the coronavirus pandemic at WPR.org/Central Time. We've got links to their work online and ways you can participate, too. Coming up after the news, we'll talk to the author of a new kids book that takes us through some of the crazy stories and compelling characters you might not have heard about from baseball history. No baseball to watch now, but some great stories here. It's a kids book, but this grown-up learned a lot along the way. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Wisconsin's Department of Health Services has released the Badger Bounce Back, a plan to gradually reopen the state's economy that's closely tied to federal guidelines. We'll get the details in just a bit. First, baseball isn't happening right now, and that means our memories of baseball may be more important than ever. Our next guest has collected some of the great stories and characters in baseball history, many of which you may not have heard of before. I hadn't heard of many of them. Derek Barnes is an award-winning author of a number of children's books, including the Ruby and the Booker Boys series. His latest nonfiction book is called Who Got Game? Baseball, Amazing but True Stories. Derek, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, man, thanks for having me. Good to be on.
Well, your book, I don't know if it came out at a bad time or a good time. There's no baseball, but maybe people need stories like this even more than they usually would. You're a big sports fan, your family too. How are you doing with the lack of sports right now?
Oh, man, you know, I'm just one of those guys. I just try to take it as it comes. You know, I had a big 20 city rated sports radio tour plan. I got canceled. I had a big 14 city tour planned by the publishing company. I have three sons that run track. I have one son is one of the best high school cornerbacks in the state, and all that stuff is canceled, man. So now it's just trying to keep everybody's head straight, make sure they stay trained up, and make sure they take care of their assignments every day. And, you know, the country will be back in business. The world will be back in business. But until then, let's just keep moving forward. You know, let's just keep taking care of our business so we can be ready when everything does get back to going. So.
Now, what made you want to share stories, you know, maybe off the beaten path, not the household names of baseball, but cool stories that we might not have heard of?
Well, I know I am a big information stats geek. I've always been that way. I've always liked to know more information than my buddy. So I've always thought it was cool to be able to, you know, provide facts and information that people couldn't readily find. You can't just get on Wikipedia or Google and find out that Sadaro, who's a Japanese player, he actually owns the record for the most home runs in baseball history. But, you know, because he didn't, you know, he never played in the United States, he never played in the MLB, he didn't go up against the level of competition that a Hank Aaron or Babe Ruth or, you know, many of these players run against. And, you know, the diameters of the baseball diamonds in Japan were a lot smaller when he was playing. So that's probably why he never got the credit. But he sent a lot of balls soaring out of stadiums, you know, in Asia. So, you know, just people like him.
Now, you introduce us to a lot of interesting characters, some from the earliest days of baseball. I want to meet actually the person you opened the book with, in effect, Rube Foster. Can you tell us about Rube and his career as a player, then a manager, and then a, you know, impresario of a league?
Yeah, Rube has been called the father of the Negro Leagues, which, you know, when we hear that term Negro Leagues, we think that it was just one league, kind of like like the MLB was. But over a course of 60 to 70 years, the Negro Leagues were a succession of different leagues all around the country. Before Reuben Foster had the idea of forming an actual league of teams that were owned by black men, a lot of black teams, a lot of teams that fielded, you know, Latino players, they were traveling baseball teams. But Rube Foster came up with the idea because he was an excellent pitcher on a lot of these traveling teams. He came up with the idea in 1920 in my hometown of Kansas City, Missouri. I'm a big Royals fan. At a local YMCA, and he called all these owners together from all these different teams from Philadelphia, Chicago, and they formed the very first Negro League in 1920, 1921, the first games happened. And Rube Foster gets the credit for that, for being an excellent businessman, organizer, and just, you know, showing the entire country that black men were excellent athletes and could play this sport. And it's all because of him, I feel like, that, you know, the game is as diverse as it is now.
And I promised earlier in the show that we'd hear the story of the young woman who struck out two of the legends of the game, Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig. Can you tell us about Jackie Mitchell?
Jackie Mitchell was actually a teenager when this happened. Now, this was an exhibition game. It was a local team. She played for the Tennessee Lookouts. And they went up against a whole team full of all-stars. And Babe Ruth was one of those all-stars. And the game was actually supposed to be played on April Fool's Day. So that's what leads a lot of baseball historians to believe that maybe this was a hoax, that maybe she wasn't that good of a pitcher. But when she went up against Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig back-to-back, she actually whiffed both of these guys. I mean, left them swinging, three and out, you know. And, you know, to this day, some baseball historians still vouch for her that this wasn't a hoax, that she was actually an excellent pitcher, because these guys had never seen anybody with this, you know, with this sort of technique and skill, because obviously women did not play baseball at that time. But this teenage girl, she had some smoke for these guys, man. And she threw that heat. So
we're talking to Derek Barnes. His new book is Who Got Game? Baseball, Amazing But True Stories. Well, now here's a story, a final score, 26-23. It's not an NFL game, though. It is actually a baseball game. Can you tell us? That is, I think, the highest scoring game ever that we know of?
Highest scoring game ever, man. 26-23. When I was looking for stats, I was trying to think of, you know, individual stats, but I was like, man, what is the highest and lowest scoring games that have ever been played? And man, I looked up the fastest pitches, people who hit grand slams in their first times at bat. But I said, man, what was the highest scoring game ever? And to my surprise, a lot of these records were set by, you know, Triple A teams, but this record actually was set by the Phillies and the Chicago Cubs in 1922, and it was a very small crowd. It was only 7,000 people there. Obviously, there was not a lot of defense played. There was not a lot of defense played. So, yeah, the Phillies and the Phillies and the Cubs. We just don't see that kind of scoring anymore. But both of those teams at the time, they were very offensive minded. You know, this was after the dead ball era, when, you know, the league was very high on hitting. Home runs became very sexy. Hitting became sexy, and yeah, these guys set a record that hasn't been touched yet. So
I want to ask us about a player, actually, who I think is important to you. You grew up near a stadium named after him, if I understand this correctly, the legendary Satchel yes. Paige. That's Satchel a little more Paige. Of a household name, but tell us his story.
Well, I had to include Satch because, you know, again, I'm from Kansas City. There's so many statues. There's the stadium is right around the corner from my house. There's even a school named after him. And he was just very flashy, very, you know, flamboyant. He could fill the stadiums because he was one of those guys that fans love to see. He made a point out of, you know, humiliating batters. if a guy couldn't hit or he wasn't a very strong power hitter, he would call the infielders in, because he knew he would strike the guy out, or maybe he would even get a full piece of his pitch. But you know, Satch was very long limb guy. He can pitch any kind of pitch, you know, that you can name: slow, curve. He can throw fastballs. He was just a very well versed pitcher, and many consider him the greatest pitcher of all times. He's from Mobile, Alabama, but we have accepted him as our own in Kansas City. And the guy didn't get he played for the Kansas City Monarchs. He didn't get a chance to play in the majors until he was 42 years old. And he played in 1948 with the Cleveland Indians, and actually took them to the World Series. He was the first black player to pitch in a Major League Championship game.
Well, Derek, as we wrap up, I know you've written a lot of fiction books for kids in the past, but I remember, you know, I learned a lot about letters and numbers on baseball cards. The first mm-hmm. biography I ever read was of Mark Fidrich, the Detroit Tigers, brief rookie sensation. Do you hope that maybe this kind of book can bring a lot of kids into reading and numbers and things like that who might not otherwise have picked up books?
Yeah, you know, it's just something. It's something very fascinating about stats. This is the first book in a three book sports series. But baseball, more than any other sport, is about numbers. It's about records. And my whole mentality is records are made to be broken. But it's so fascinating to understand how these records are set, and how these records are broken, how long these records stand. And, you know, for kids that, you know, collect trading cards or are as fascinated as I was when I was a kid about stats and how long those records were held, this is the perfect book for not just baseball fans, but not even for sports fans, because, again, that, there are a lot of fascinating individuals in this book, and I am very big on, you know, genealogy, understanding how people became great and where they came from. And so I try to fill this book with as many fascinating stories as I possibly can. And maybe they won't be baseball fans. Hopefully they will. But even more so, we just, trying to develop competent and strong readers. So,
Derek, thanks so much for being with us today. I appreciate it.
Yes, thank you very much for having me.
That's Derek Barnes, award-winning children's book author. He was with us to talk about his latest book. It's called Who Got Game? Baseball Amazing But True Stories. Coming up, we'll look at the details of the governor's plan to gradually reopen the state's economy and hear about the response it's getting. That's up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, how do you communicate about a potentially deadly crisis? In 2009, the CDC was faced with letting the public know about an emerging virus known as H1N1 or the swine flu. We'll talk about how that pandemic was talked about in the media and what we can learn for the COVID-19 outbreak. Now, Wisconsin's Department of Health Services released a plan yesterday to reopen the state's economy and ease stay-at-home restrictions in three phases. The plan, being called the Badger Bounce Back, is based in part on guidelines released last week by President Trump's coronavirus task force. During a video press conference announcing the plan, Governor Evers reiterated that steps toward resuming normal activities need to be balanced with public health.
No one wants to reopen our economy as much as I do, but folks, like I've said before, it has to be more like turning a dial than flipping a light switch. And that's why safer at home is so important, so that we can continue to make sure our healthcare workers and system aren't overwhelmed while we're taking important steps to be able to turn down that dial safely and sooner.
As of today, over 4,600 people in Wisconsin have tested positive for COVID-19. 242 have died from the disease. More than 46,000 Wisconsinites have tested negative. Rob Mentzer is WPR's rural communities reporter based in Wausau. Rob, good to have you back.
Hey, thanks.
Well, there's a lawsuit from Republican leaders in the legislature against the extended safer at home order. We're going to talk about that on the show tomorrow. Let's dig into this plan now from the governor and the Department of Health Services. What does phase one look like in this multi-phase plan?
So the first thing to note is that phase one doesn't start until Wisconsin has hit certain metrics, including 14-day declines in positive cases or in sort of flu-like cases. So Wisconsin has a decline in positives today compared to yesterday, but yesterday was an increase. So that's like, so it's a couple weeks away before even the first phase would start. What phase one looks like in this, the governor's plan is gatherings of up to 10 people would be allowed. Restaurants would be allowed to open as long as they follow social distancing requirements. And all schools and childcare centers would open in phase one.
Let's talk about the preliminaries, what would happen before each phase is progressed to. There's a federal guideline for states to use. How closely does Wisconsin's plan match up with what is coming from the federal government?
Pretty closely. So the Trump administration put out guidelines on this on Thursday. They have exactly the same guidance on the 14-day declines. Explicitly say that hospitals can't be overwhelmed. There needs to be enough capacity in hospitals outside of ICUs and so on. The governor adopted that language exactly. And then some other some other things. Healthcare workers need to have robust access to testing. The governor did set some more ambitious goals when it comes to availability of tests for Wisconsinites, and also outlined a plan to hire 1,000 people to do contact tracing, which is the way public health officials track, hopefully contain any new outbreaks. So, there are some differences, but the reality is that the plans are very similar, and in many respects, Governor Evers is following the White House guidance.
So we talk a little bit about phase one, and then phase two and phase three, as I read it, Rob, take steps from where we are at phase one and bring us closer one step at a time to normal, quote unquote. Is that right?
Right, that's right. Yeah, phase two, you can have gatherings of up to 50 people. Restaurants are open at full capacity. Bars are open with social distancing requirements. In phase three, pretty much everything is open. Now, what is significant, or what we, you know, it needs to be understood, is that the order specifically says that the state is going to use up-to-date data and decide when it's appropriate to progress. It doesn't lay out any kind of like specific timeline on exactly when we would move from one to the next. So there's a roadmap here, but what there is not is a strict time on when it would happen.
Talking to Rob Menser, WPR Rural Communities reporter based in Wausau, about Governor Evers and the Department of Health Services' plan to work Wisconsin back toward a more normal economy. Rob, what's been the response to this from Republicans in particular?
Well, I mean, of course, so Republicans have filed the lawsuit today that they had threatened on this. And that was the response even yesterday afternoon that, we're moving forward with our legal challenge against these restrictions. I have seen some Republican legislators making statements questioning the for instance, the feasibility of the contact tracing plan or of the necessity of scaling up testing, as the governor has called for. A bunch of assembly Republicans also signed onto a letter last week that outlined a 4-week plan that would open all businesses and allow all social gatherings by the third week in May. So that may be if we're looking at sort of polls, that's kind of a spectrum of where politicians in Wisconsin stand, I guess.
And one concern I know that's been raised is the idea hey, do we need a one-size-fits-all approach here when some counties are really hard hit? Some counties haven't had a positive test yet. What's been that? What's been the talk about maybe a more tailored regional or county-by-county or whatever kind of approach?
Right. This is something that the Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald has explicitly made reference to, and other Republican leaders. They hold the view that in some of the more rural counties where the numbers are lower, that there should be flexibility to open things up sooner. The governor addressed that explicitly yesterday in the press conference by saying that it may be true in some respects, but a lot of times the rural counties also have fewer resources to deal with an outbreak in terms of hospital beds and so on. And I think also, I mean, like we all know it, people move throughout the state. I mean, we're coming into the tourist season where people from the southern part of the state travel up north, and we'll see what happens, but it would seem reasonable to expect that type of movement could lead to more outbreaks in rural parts of the state.
As we wrap up, Rob, what are you watching for next in this story that changes in many ways from day to day?
Well, so there is the legal challenge. As we saw with the spring election, the state Supreme Court has a conservative majority. It is reasonable to think that they may be sympathetic to the legislature's arguments on this. The nature of that is the lawsuit in particular is not challenging the state of emergency that extends through May 11th. So one thing to watch, or possible way that this could go, is that we could see some of these, we could see a court decision that chooses to unwind or overturn some of the restrictions after that public health emergency expires on May 11th.
Rob, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Rob Menser, WPR's Rural Communities reporter based in Wausau. He talked with us about the Badger Bounce Back, a plan put forth by the State Department of Health Services to gradually reopen Wisconsin's economy in three phases. Some changes already coming in safer at home orders after the extension begins at the end of this week going into the weekend. We'll keep following that story, including watching for the progress of that lawsuit Rob was talking about in the state Supreme Court. Thanks to everyone who supported Wisconsin Public Radio and our coverage of COVID-19 and everything else we talk about. Thank you so much for giving during our sort of low-key spring member drive. It really does make a difference. Thank you. Museums in countries around the world are closed during the pandemic, but they're doing their best to share their collections online in the meantime. And sometimes they're getting pretty competitive about it, in a friendly museum-y way. The Yorkshire Museum in England has been leading the way with a weekly competition they're calling the Curator Battle. Each week they issue a challenge on Twitter with a different theme and invite museums to share the best entries in their collections. Themes have included the deadliest object and the best egg over Easter week. A lot of those entries were from museums in the Yorkshire area, but their newest challenge has gotten international attention. It's for the creepiest object in a museum's collection. The Yorkshire Museum itself started things off with a hair bun from the burial of a Roman woman in the 200s or 300s. It's a little creepy, but things got real. Real creepy. The National Sciences Museum of Scotland entered a mermaid carcass, which actually turned out to be a combination of fish remains, taxidermy, and sculpture. I can't do this thing justice. Let's just say you could get a horror movie and two or three sequels just from looking at this. The Prince Edward Island Museum in Canada entered what they say is a cursed rolling toy that looks like a sheep, maybe, found in the walls of an abandoned mansion. It supposedly moves around on its own. The Museum of Fear and Wonder in Alberta, Canada, shared a 19th century German child mannequin. The Bell Museum in Minnesota shared a naturally mummified pigeon. If you need some nightmare fuel, find more on Twitter. Look for the hashtag CuratorBattle. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.